Embodied mindfulness, living with intensity, harboring it. For the 7th episode of the series on Somatic Philosophy, whatever that might be, I'm talking to Kelly Pride, coach, mentor, and founder of the Gifted Mindfulness Collective. Her details are in the blog post text, who is Skyping with me from Toronto, Canada. I'm coughing from time to time and perhaps not always talking straight into my mic. And there is a showery sound in the background that comes and goes. Apologies, and I hope you stay with us anyway. So here's part one of our conversation. You can find this and all of the other episodes on philoprax.se. That's F-I-L-O-P-R-A-X. Look for articles and podcasts in the menu tab.
In everyday lingo, we separate the body from the self.
Yes.
And it's possible for us to have the experience of not being ourselves, or at least we can look back and say, when I was not myself. But then, So I can, but I want to take this moment now and just say that I feel that I wasn't in my body. I wasn't in my body for several years.
Yeah.
You know, and now I am, now that I'm 40 and, you know, now I'm like inhabiting this, I'm looking down at where I'm sitting here cross-legged on my daughter's
the rest
bed.
Yeah. That's been very similar to my journey too. It's not been until my 40s where I started going, oh, wait a second. There's this whole other part of me that I'm like, what is happening down there? You know? And how do I reconnect with that? How do I, you know, expand my awareness of self so that it includes that?
Precisely. Yeah.
Yes, that was part of my journey for sure, because, you know, I'm in my late 40s now. And, you know, I think for most of us, the first, you know, once we start school and, you know, we have about two decades at least, you know, where it's all about thinking and cognitive processing and problem solving and memorizing and all of the thinking stuff. And, you know, I went to university and I was there. I was at university for 10 years because I just loved to think. I still love to think, but, you know, but it was just constantly caught up in the, you know, the logic and the rational thought and the figuring out of things that I was really, and researching that I was really enthralled with. And the interesting thing was that I started out at university in the dance program. I was a dancer.
I was just thinking, and what you do at university in school is you just sit on a chair, but actually you didn't. You were dancing.
There were lots of elements of sitting and thinking, but then, you know, we had the studio component of it too, where we were actually dancing and using our bodies. And, you know, obviously you're still thinking when you're doing that, but it's a much more automatic, habitual kind of thing that it's a different mode of processing. And so I spent many hours a week doing that as well. But you know, looking back on that, I think, oh my gosh, I still, even back then, was so much in my head. I don't think I was as good of a dancer as I could have been had I been more connected to my body. But, you know, I ended up going into graduate school, and I stopped dancing. And so that got me even more out of my body. You know, and much more in my head. And I spent many years in graduate school studying psychology and clinical work. And by the time I came out of that, you know, then I started a family. And then that's a whole other level of thinking, right? Where you're trying to problem solve and figure out, oh my gosh, how do I do this parenting thing? And I've got these little beings now that I need to take care of. And how am I going to do that? And so, yeah, so it was just constantly being in my head. And the further I got along in life, the more and more I got disconnected from my body. And I think probably about 10 years maybe into parenting, I was so stuck in my head, and I was just really overwhelmed. The parenting journey was a real struggle for me, which is a whole other conversation. But I would love to have. I'm sure you and I could have a wonderful conversation on that. But I was so in my head, and I was just being overwhelmed by thinking and feeling, like overwhelming thought and feeling. And I was not in a good place. And so I started doing meditation as a way of managing, trying to get some relief from the suffering in my own mind. And meditation was the only thing, that really worked for me.
How did you get and that it worked idea there, to start with meditation? Because it can also be a very foreign thing if you're, especially when I was the most in my head, it was the last thing that I thought I would do. Meditate. No, you know?
Yeah. You know what? It was not my first thought. I had tried everything else. Oh. That was the issue. You know, I had been to counseling over the years. I had, you know, I think a large part of why I ended up doing a PhD in psychology was to try to figure out myself, figure out, you know, my experience of things and the intensity that I experienced things. And that was not helping me. You know, all of those years of understanding the mind and human behavior, and I couldn't understand myself or get kind of some kind of management of my thought and emotion. And so I just felt like I had tried everything else and nothing worked. And I was feeling so desperate. I knew I needed to do something. And meditation just kind of popped into my head. It was one of those things, you know, that just kind of reveals itself. And I had always been interested in, you know, Buddhism and the Eastern wisdom traditions. I had tried meditation on my own, not very successfully.
No, it's hard.
It is hard on your own. Yeah, without guidance and a group to practice with. So I just found a local, I just looked up meditation in my area, and there was a local Zen group, and I thought, okay, I'm going to go and check it out. And I had such a profound experience the first time I tried it, and I just kept going back and noticing the transformation over time. And so that was really, I went into that trying to, you know, manage my thoughts and feelings a little bit better. And then after so many years, you kind of get to a place where I was like, you know, wait a second, there's this whole other part of me below my head that I did not have any connection with. And it seemed to me that a part of deepening my practice and expanding my practice, of mindfulness and meditation, I had to go and figure that out. You know, I had to go into that space and figure out how to reconnect with this body and what is going on in there. And that has, you know, I've been doing that for the last couple of years now, and that's just been a profound experience for me. So that's been sort of my journey from mind, that we think about mind as just the head, really, and as being separate from the body, but the mind and the body is part of the mind.
The body, you know, is part of the mind.
The body is part of the mind. It's part and parcel of the same process, is what I discovered.
Oh, I love that. The body is part of the mind. Yes. So if you want to expand your mind, you need to move into the body.
Yes.
I wish someone had told me earlier.
A big aha.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so mindfulness for me is, I love the Spanish translation of mindfulness, which is conciencia plena, which means full awareness. And so for me, this awareness of mind and expanding that awareness from just what's going on in your head to, you know, incorporating all of the sensory experience that's coming through the body. And yeah, so mind all of a sudden expands to a huge level. And then to think that, you know, that is interconnected with other people's, you know, whole mind process that's going on. And all of that is in, like, it's like this ecosystem, right? And then you can start talking about relational mindfulness at that point, which is, you know, a whole other thing that I'm just starting to explore. But for me, the first thing was figuring out, okay, what is my own experience, and trying to get a handle on what was going on in my own experience, my own inner experience. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see this has also happened when I've been making this series and thinking about what's been said and everything. There's this wonderful dynamic between the individual and the, I don't even want to use these words, but it's like, it's not the individualism as in the 20th century elbows out hierarchy, prove the ego fulfillment individualism, but the other individualist, like the necessity of experiencing your separateness, but not as a sad and lonely thing, but to fully experience your separateness, the necessary separateness of, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And then the looping back, the boomeranging back to the relational and the universal mind. You know, it's so hard to talk about these things without
sounding. I know. There's I forget who came up with the concept of it. I want to say it's from the field of economics, but there's this idea of, you know, moving from ego system to ecosystem. Which I love, because, you know, we've spent so many years being in that ego system, and you know, we're still there in so many ways. But, you know, this idea of moving to ecosystem, and I think there's the kind of the two parts to it, but not two parts to it. Like you said, it's really hard to put language around it, but there's, you know, your kind of own individual experience of it, and making sure that you have, that your mind is clear and your mind is open, and doing the work that you need to do to have it clear and open and aware so that it can connect to the ecosystem in a healthy way. Right?
Yeah, this is Kabbalistic idea. I don't know very much Kabbalah, but I've heard that there's this idea that God created us, sort of planted us, not planted, but planted us a little bit, a certain distance away and facing the other way, you know, so that we would, as we grow, we would turn our heads to God and start walking back.
Oh.
Isn't it nice?
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, that does.
So this is also the ego to the eco, and and the necessity of clearing the space inside. I'm so interested in the in what happens when you get so stuck that nothing can flow through, nothing comes in, nothing goes out. You just have this repetitive system of your own narrative. Well, now it's always like this again. Well, typical, it's raining, just my luck. And then everything is in your, is in the same structure. So whatever anyone says will just fit in the narrative that's already there. And this is the closedness. Like this, it's so, to be open is so important, to be open. And what do I mean by open? What I mean by open is aware, you know, I suppose, suppose I mean.
Yeah. Well, the way I often conceptualize it and explain it when I'm teaching mindfulness and working with clients is, you know, when we have these very difficult experiences or experiences that our minds label as difficult, and we don't have a complete experience of what is going on in our mind and in our system, it figuratively, these knots kind of form in our system. They become entangled. It's like entangled sensory experience. It's entanglements of thought and all of the beliefs and all of the stories that we're so good at creating story. I mean, language is a wonderful thing, but it can be a really debilitating thing too, because we put all these stories around things, and then there's all the feeling that gets wrapped up in that. And then there's the sensations that are all, they get all knotted up together when we don't have a complete experience of it. And it forms little knots in our system, in our mind. And, you know, that's how trauma happens. That's like a really, you know, that's an experience that is so overwhelming to the system that it can't process it, and it stores it, right? It stores it, and sort of like, so over time, we have all of these little knots that form. And, you know, this is one of the reasons I love being around kids, because they're so open. They don't have any of these knots yet.
Yes.
You know, they're just so open and clear, and there's just this flow that is happening through them. And it's just wonderful to be in their presence. They have this wonderful presence about them. You know, but then it's over time that we have all of these difficult experiences, and we don't know how to process them and metabolize them in our systems. And it forms all of these little knots. And so these are the things that, you know, create the blockages for the flow of our expression of who we are to actually happen, and the incoming of information as well, because these knots are kind of blocking the channel.
Yeah, they do really block. I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
No.
Oh, yeah, they do. They really do block. And the weird thing about them is that they are sort of language is what makes them, creates them, because it's like the narrative response to difficult experiences. Okay, not all of them. I remember now, like, not trauma that happens when you're very, very young. But say, for instance, one of my favorite books that I read. I'm the type of person who reads the same book several times. So I read one of the.
Me too. I do that too. Yeah.
One of the books that I read at least 10 times when I was in my 20s. It was a story of. Like it was called The Children of Paradise, but it was literally the story of Eve, and then went on to be a book about Cain, and then their younger sister, who I don't think, maybe she made it up, this writer, but it was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book. And in it, there's this, scene where this girl gets to meet kind of oracle person who says everybody at some point in our childhood chooses a lie, and this is your personal lie by which you live then. And it's something like, for instance, you're in a situation where you see okay, so I'll just do my own example. So my dad got ill, very ill, when I was 5. And I think at that point, I chose to the lesson, like the lesson I, my mind, my conscious linguistic mind told myself to learn was, it doesn't matter what I do. And it, see what I'm saying? And then, much later, like in my, in my 20s, I had these situations where I had suddenly I had two friends. I'm being very personal now, but never mind. It's maybe somebody will be helped by it. So in my 20s, I suddenly had within like a couple of weeks, I had two separate friends come to me and say that they wished I would be more loyal. And I was completely shocked. I didn't even understand what they were talking about.
Oh.
And then after we. When we discussed what, you know, things, and I figured it's this, it's now I get it from this book. It's like my lie. I figured, it doesn't matter what I do, but it's not true. You know, it was just my mind just made this rule up.
Yes.
So that I could survive this awful event where I couldn't help my dad.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, so that was. Like in one, that was one of my knots. And the weird thing and the stupid bad thing about these knots is that you don't notice them. You just like, they don't stand there. I'm a knot, trip over me. They're this bland color that you don't see. And they tend, you know, it's.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's their whole purpose is, you know, it's a protective mechanism where it's sort of like our system going, oh my gosh, this was so much for you to process and handle. And it was too much for you. Yeah. So here, I'm going to bundle this up for you and tuck it away. So you don't have to deal with it and you can go on because we're wired to survive.
Yes.
Right. And so and it's actually, it's brilliant when you think about how, you know, how our system protects us in that way.
Yeah, the alternative, like psychosis, is unbearable. So,
Yeah, and so much of these knots do happen when we're young because we don't have the maturity and the experience to be able to process a lot of things and you know, understand them and be able to try to make some sense out of them or at least process them in a way that we can deal with the experience in a skillful way. You know, we, you know, process it in the way that a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old mind would process it. And then that becomes a thing. It becomes a thing to protect you and help you survive.
Yes. I think that's really important. It becomes a thing because there is now something, a knot where there should not be anything.
Yes.
Ideally.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. And with the mindfulness, meditation, Zen awareness, you are opening again and making sure there is no thing.
Well, you are, you know, sort of shining the light of mindfulness on, okay, what's going on in here? And, you know, sort of like going down into the cellar. Where you haven't been for many, many years and you've just put all these things in boxes and trunks and
you're like, I don't have a cellar. I live on this floor now.
Yeah. So mindfulness is kind of, and this is where kind of the misnomer is with mindfulness and meditation is people think, oh, it's just, you know, you're going to zen out and it's going to be blissful and relaxation. And I mean, you can certainly have that element of it and just do that. That's, you know, that could be your mindfulness practice. But you know, the real practice is going into all of these unconscious spaces and looking what's there, and most of the time this stuff starts to reveal itself on its own, right? When you, and I don't know, maybe that's something that happens in our 40s, you know, that you're life or your mind just starts to feel ready to start tackling some of these things. And so some of these things start to come to the surface, you know, and to be dealt with and to be healed.
To be healed.
And so part of mindfulness is, you know, looking at these knots and kind of untangling them and taking them apart. And, you know, for some people, it's really important. And I'm very careful to say that with mindfulness that, you know, some things, when you have these deep knots that are, you know, from traumatic experiences, it's really important to have the help of a therapist or a coach or somebody who can help you process that. Because some of these things, a lot comes up and it's, you know, it can be a lot to try to manage on your own. So it's really important to have support if these things do start revealing themselves and start coming up for healing. But yeah, that's been a huge part of my mindfulness practice is, you know, having these things come up and taking a look at them and starting to untangle them and metabolize them to clear them out. And once the knot kind of untangles and, you know, goes back into the flow of your experience, of your inner sensory process, then it opens up.
Why is it important to be opened up? I'm just asking for the, you know, let's just say, put words to it. Why is it important?
Well, if you think, I'm going to explain it through a metaphor. So if you think of a hose that is designed for water to flow through it, and there's a knot in the hose, you know, the water is going to start to back up. And the hose is going to start to expand in places where it's not designed to expand. You know, you run the risk of getting a leak in the hose, of the hose exploding. It's not channeling the water and dispersing the water in the way that it was designed to. And, you know, our systems, we're the same way. You know, we're organisms that are designed to take things in, process it, and have a flow of information that goes out. So the same thing happens when we have these knots. Things get backed up. Things are not flowing the way through the system, the way that they're supposed to. And then so it distorts the expression of who we are. It distorts our behavior, it distorts how we perceive things. You know, everything starts to become distorted. And then, so we're not, when that flow through our system is not happening, we're not living authentically anymore.
Good.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when we, you know, open up these knots and things, information comes in and it flows through and it gets processed the way it's supposed to. And then we can, you know, express ourselves and have the sensory information coming out in the way that it was designed to through our system. That's how we become authentic beings. And, you know, can express ourselves in the way that we were meant to.
Yes. I love the word authenticity. I'm trying to tackle this, authenticity, why is it important? Why is it good to be authentic? Well, you know, there are some very obvious answers, like you get unhealthy if you're not authentic. But for someone, let's say someone's listening and they think, so what if I can learn to express myself? I have nothing to say. There's no one's going to need to listen to what I have to say. There's really nothing. I am not a special person. I can imagine at least two or three people in my that I've met in my life who might say something like that. Should we just leave them? What do we say? Okay.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, one of the things with one of the things that I've come to learn through mindfulness is that it's not really about having anything to say. You know, and so I think about my relationship with my kids, for example. And I've got two teenagers. They're often not interested in what I have to say. You know, let's be honest. They're often not. It's sort of like, and you know, one of them is a boy, a 15-year-old boy, and he's, you know, a very visual thinker. So he's not that interested in verbal information. So me talking is not helpful. But when he, what I have learned is that when he is having a hard time with something and really struggling with something, and, you know, he's in a very intense place, I don't have to say anything. In fact, it's probably better that I don't say anything. And I can, my, and I'm not saying that I'm, you know, this perfectly open flow of sensory information by any stretch of the means, but through my mindfulness practice, I have been able to create this kind of spaciousness and an openness that I have found when my kids are struggling with something, or even when I'm with a client, just being in that space and not saying anything, but just having a presence and creating that spaciousness and openness for them gives them the space to process what they're processing, and allows them to feel safe, and allows them to feel like they can just be in that space, in that moment, with whatever it is that they're dealing with. And that presence, that spaciousness and openness is so transformative. That's what I found. And we all have that. All have that.
Yeah.
You know? And I love what, I think Ram Dass is, I think he has a book, and he is, that's titled, or he talks about in a book, you know, we're all just walking each other home. We're all just walking each other home, and we're on this planet together at this time. And, you know, we get caught up in the ecosystem stuff and we forget about this ecosystem thing. And, you know, nobody is not part of that ecosystem. You know, no matter what your experience has been, you are part of that ecosystem.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So it, you don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything. And that's, I think, where we think, you know, from the ego system standpoint, that we have to say something remarkable, or we have to have achieved something for anybody to take us seriously, or, you know, we have to have the big job or the big title for us to be worthy of something, you know. And the ecosystem model does not recognize any of that. That's just not part of it. You know, we're all part of this system together, walking each other home. And we've forgotten that. And, you know, just look at the state of the planet and where we are. You know, we're in crisis mode because we've forgotten that.
Yes, I'm like, I don't know, I'm giggling. Oh, it's some kind of relief, I think. But so I think I got, when we said authenticity and then expression, so it sounded like a sort of a place where, you know, you have to find your creative spark and this thing that you can do and nobody else. And, you know, but it's really, like you said, the, to be present and to hold space for someone else is an expression of participation and of saying, I understand that I am here walking you home. You know, I understand that I'm doing it, and I want to do it, and I am doing it, you know. So that's what you're expressing by just being present. I recorded another episode. It's in English, that you can listen to it if you don't want to learn Swedish just now. But so it's the one called Heather. So she has started doing a kind of talking therapy where you are lying on a this massage table, and she's tapping you with certain places, like on your forehead and the cheek.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Yes.
And
yes.
She, yes. And she said that at a certain point, therapy is really great, like when you go to talk to a psychologist. But I don't believe that you can get well from only talking. And she had she had talked to someone who had gone to therapy for a long time and said, like, oh, I love therapy and blah, blah, blah. And this person had just asked her, but are you getting better? And it was such a potent question that you need to be able to say, I'm not just like expanding on my narrative or like changing the story to put myself in a better light.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm actually not bothered by so much talking in my head and so much like explaining. You know, I sometimes, you know, when I'm not aligned or, you know, I'm hungry or angry or something, or and some of my you know, I get annoyed with my daughter or whatever. And then, so I snap, and then afterwards I apologize. I've become better at apologizing quickly, at least.
Oh yes,
yes. Then, yeah, it's good. It's good. When you can't, if you can't do one, you can do the other.
Yes.
Yeah. But then I ask myself what happened, and then often I can like know I'm walking into the talkative room in my head now. That's just going like, well, because, and he would have cheated. And I'm like, this is too much talking. When I'm in that room, I'm completely disconnected from the higher self or whatever, you know, because it's the higher self or the whatever thing that you can also contact inside. It doesn't have so many words. It has only two words, yes or no.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean when I say yes or just two words? Like you can, when you look at, if you like ask inside, you can only ask yes or no questions. Should I apologize? Yes.
Right. Right. Yes. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And it doesn't go yes, because then you're, and then, you know, you're not talking to the core.
Right. Yes.
I'm not as crazy as that sounded.
Oh no, that. You know what? That sounds spot on. That sounds spot on. Because, you know, so we do that, and that's what the mind does. You know, it just like goes off on these loops and tangents, and you know, that's the story making that we get hooked into. And yes, like part of the healing experience, I mean, talking and sharing your story is important for sure.
Yeah.
And is healing, but only up to a certain point. And the, you know, the knots that we were talking about earlier, those protective knots, don't speak logic. The part of the nervous system that is doing that work and holding on to them does not speak language. And, you know, that's sort of where somatics comes in, because we, in order to fully process it, we have to be able to connect with the felt experience.
Yes. Oh, the felt experience. I love that. Now it's Eugene Gendon. Have you read that book, Focusing?
Yes.
Yes. Love it.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, we have to be able to go into that felt experience and process that. And that is beyond language and logic.
When you were talking, I just wrote it quickly. Language heals the language damage. So telling your story and getting the healing from understanding which words and you use in your narrative, and the different parts that you make the different characters play.
Yes.
So talking about that will heal the narrative itself, you know, with the language damage was done. That doesn't really feel right, language damage. But you understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
It's for that specific realm, but we also need the other realms. And the thing is, they're all interconnected. So you can never just, you can never heal the whole person by just one.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, and that's where I find this analogy of a knot really helpful, because the story element is just one strand of the knot. So, you know, we can focus on that and kind of tease that apart, but then there's the whole felt experience of it. You know, that's a really big part of that knot as well. And we have to be able to go in and disentangle that.
Yeah.
to fully release it. And that's the tough part. That's, you know, where we often need, and that's where it can be hard to find a good therapist.
Yes.
You know, who can help you do that, because so much of therapy is just talking and putting these cognitive frameworks around things to, you know, help you reframe how you're thinking about it.
Yes, either that or you focus entirely on how things feel, for instance, but not in the body sense.
Yeah.
You know, like whether you are something makes you upset. And then you cry and you think that after the tears are gone, you'll be fine. This was completely ridiculous because after my dad died, I had these trigger words like cancer and dad and death and stuff. I couldn't even see those words anywhere.
Yeah.
And if I did, I would start crying and I couldn't stop for like 2 days or something. So the idea that tears will make you free and you need to cry out the grief, that was like not applicable whatsoever.
Yeah. What do we do when there's such a, I was going to say, disconnect between mind and body, the language triggers and the crying? But it's not a disconnect and it's not a connect either. It's more like a failure to separate the sphere of language and symbolism from felt reality. Where the word death becomes death itself. I'm reminded again of those wise words that someone said. Wisdom is memory.